This is Katerina Koliva, the Executive Director of the Council of Deans of Health, and I'm delighted to have with me Stacey Johnson, MBE, Associate Professor at Nottingham University. Stacey, welcome.
Thank you, Katerina. Very happy to be here with you.
Thank you so much for being with me this afternoon. And we are in the middle of our campaign, UniHealth, hashtag UniHealth, which is a Council of Deans campaign showcasing the work that our members, university healthcare faculties, have done and continue to do during the COVID-19 pandemic. And as we had the COVID-19 pandemic, another pandemic that has been longer around us, that of racism, became just stronger recently because of the Black Lives Matter movement and the George Floyd tragic death. And I just wanted to start with your personal reflections on Black Lives Matter and what's currently happening across the country and across the world.
Yes, gosh, so much happening, and it seems to be constant, you know, every day. I mean, I'm sure you know I'm a big Twitter fan, and literally every day there's something new, something different, a different angle that I hadn't considered before. I guess my reflections are that, you know, this is nothing new, and it's certainly nothing new for Black people. You know, there are, I suspect, so many, you know, weekly deaths of unarmed Black people in the United States. There have been deaths in police custody, for example, in the United Kingdom. This is not new. Perhaps, I don't know if because of the COVID pandemic, people's reserves of resilience and their tolerance is lower. And this is why we've seen this really quite seismic response globally to this death. So, you know, I guess I want to say to colleagues who are not Black, welcome to my world. Right. So you're seeing it. It's all over the news. You probably have more time than you normally would because people are on lockdown and you're noticing it more. But you speak to the average Black person. And, in fact, I recognize I'm not even the average Black person to whom this will be an even bigger thing. I have a reverse mentor, a young Black man who reverse mentors me. He's a student. And, you know, can you imagine being a young Black man or being a Black man? It must affect him even more, you know? So that's the first reflection. It's not new to many Black people, Black academics, Black colleagues or whoever, you know? What I think is quite remarkable about this now is that the scale of the response, the fact that there have been global and ongoing global demonstrations, protests, and so on. And we've seen Black Lives Matter protests in the past, but my impression certainly wasn't that it was so prolonged and so global. Okay. The second thing that I find really remarkable is the level of activism I'm seeing from colleagues who are not Black. So other BME colleagues, or Asian colleagues, friends, and so on, but also white colleagues and perfect strangers, actually, as well. And the questions they're asking, the conversations they're having, feel different to me. So in the past, people might ask me what we should do. The emphasis is very much on how it's affecting me and what I think I should do. Whereas here, now, the question seemed to be, what should we as white people be doing? The work should be done by white people. I'm seeing white people saying that, you know? And so, you know, even my language talking to you now is different. So usually it takes me a while to build up to saying white people, Black people. I have become not empowered, but emboldened by this wave of awareness. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to give permission to other people to talk about this, I'm going to have to start talking about it. So I'm just really open now talking about being Black, talking about Black people, Black staff, not even just BME, but Black, similarly referring directly to white colleagues, you know. And so for me, those have been the things that have been unusual, you know. I mean, okay, all the normal conversation about, you know, Black, saying Black Lives Matter and signing up to the Black Lives Matter movement is not an assumption that all lives don't matter, right? So it's not saying Black Lives Matter more than anybody else or any other life. It is that at the moment, We're not seeing as many unarmed people of other ethnicities being killed by police, you know? So, let's take as read all those other arguments, which is that, yeah, Black Lives Matter, as do all other lives. But, you know, I saw a really great cartoon. You know, if I walk up to you and say, can you give a donation for breast cancer? You're not going to say, oh, but all cancers matter, right? One does not have Absolutely. To be at the expense of the other, you know? So, yeah, so those are my thoughts, some of my thoughts on Black Lives Matter.
So very encouraging to hear about your reflections on change of narrative and also your reflections around this being a humanitarian issue for all people, not a political issue of a specific group of people. Mm. So I think that's kind of the change of narrative that we are experiencing. But I would like to bring this back to our core focus, which is academia. So I'd like to ask you, as an academic, have you experienced racism in academia throughout your career? And I notice you're wearing a fantastic jumper that says Black in Academia. We're going to take a picture of it and share it with our members and our audience today, but I'd like your thoughts on that. So how are we doing in terms of academic representation?
So as far as academic representation goes, we're not doing very well. And I think this is particularly important for our audience. You know, this is the Council of Deans of Health. And, you know, I know there's variation across healthcare professions. So I don't think I've actually ever met a Black speech and language therapist or a BAME Black, Asian or other minority ethnic speech and language therapist. All the way over to nursing, where I know loads of Black nurses, loads of Black, Asian and other minority ethnic nurses. So in terms of representation, in terms of the professions that we educate, we're not doing very well, because given how many Black nurses there are, and, you know, when I look out onto my undergraduate first year group of 300, quite a significant proportion of them are BME. But when I look upwards, so, you know, I think I'm in my school, I'm the only Black associate professor. You know, when I look further upwards, I know of only two female Black vice chancellors, for example. You know, we're not doing that well. So, you know, and I can understand if you're in history, many schools of history don't have very many undergraduate Black students. So then, okay, the pipeline makes sense that they won't have very many professors. But in healthcare, I wonder what is happening, you know, given that our undergraduate population is very ethnically diverse. I would say that our overarching academic staff, not very many BME academic staff generally. And then, of course, as you start going up in terms of seniority, the numbers drop off until BME staff are pretty much invisible at professorial level in healthcare, which should not be the case, you know. So lots more work to do, I think.
And I can definitely second that, because our own research and the staff census we did with our members in January 2020, mm-hmm. where we published data across the healthcare academic sector in the UK around BME representation in academia. And I'm talking here dean level, but also associate dean, head of department, professor, researcher, teacher, etc., you know, in all the education, research and governance and leadership positions, we have a disproportionate representation of BME people, even compared to the NHS. And we do much less, it's not a nice picture compared to what the NHS, and the NHS doesn't do as well either in terms of leadership. When you look, I mean, what you're describing is something we see across the board, don't we? Yeah. So I suppose we want to move on to innovation, solutions and ideas about how do we change this, because just talking about the problem constantly doesn't really help us to move forward, particularly in the current movement and with what you described in the beginning in terms of the interest, the narrative, the movement that's happening across the board. So tell me about reverse mentoring.
Yeah, so I think it does go back to what you're saying about, we don't want to be immobilized by trying to understand the problem. We don't want to be eternally trying to understand what is going on, what are the reasons, what are the explanations, right? We need to understand the explanations. The difficulty is, of course, we need to understand the explanations from a variety of perspectives, okay? And what reverse mentoring offers, and it's one of many solutions. So I never advocate reverse mentoring as the only thing an organization should be doing. They should be doing it alongside all of their other interventions for improving diversity and inclusion in organizations, right? But what reverse mentoring offers is a chance to have different conversations about not just culture, but problems with culture, not just race, but racism. And actually, we're talking about ethnicity, particularly today, but really more broadly, all other diversity. You know, so it offers the chance to talk not just about LGBTQ issues, but actually transphobia, for example, you know, and it facilitates these different conversations in a number of ways. One is it stops us having ever superficial conversations, right? So it allows you to be in a relationship with somebody in a long term where you can have deeper conversations. It also facilitates conversations that are difficult, uncomfortable. Now, we tend to train and develop the ability to retreat from difficult conversations, to de-escalate when conversations start becoming uncomfortable. And what reverse mentoring asks us to do instead is actually take the hand of the person that you're reverse mentoring and walk, lead them into discomfort, and actually roll around, really, really examine the discomfort and why you're feeling uncomfortable. What is reverse mentoring? I suppose that was where I should have started. So it is any situation in which a person who is more senior is mentored by somebody who's in a more junior position than themselves. Okay.
Is that only in the work environment, Stacey? So would it be, you know, my boss and me, and I mentor them, for example, in a crude work hierarchy?
Yeah.
Or does it cut across? Does it work as a matrix? So can it be across organizations? Can it be across sectors, across settings?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is how we're using it in the Remedy project, the Reverse Mentoring for Equality, Diversity and Inclusion, Remedy with an I project. So originally reverse mentoring was used in General Electric in the early 80s, where new graduates were reverse mentoring senior executives, specifically around using the internet. So in that way, it was the traditional, you're senior to me, it's an organizational issue, and it was specifically around digital literacy, okay? But I started seeing references to it being used with women reverse mentoring male executives in the commercial sector, Black and minority ethnic staff in the UK Cabinet Office, reverse mentoring more senior staff. And I began to wonder, and I was originally looking at it simply about solving this issue of Black and minority ethnic staff not rising above band 8 in the NHS, for example. And I started to wonder whether, look, is this not simply about where there is a difference in power, and where the person ostensibly with less power teaches, guides, educates the person with more power, okay? And there, we're creating the opportunity for it to be exactly as you describe, to be about somebody who is hierarchically or based on income or based on formal power might then be in a relationship where they're learning from somebody who is less senior in the hierarchy or who holds less power, or where that person feels they have less power. People who feel marginalized, where the organization might not recognize that they're marginalized. So that sets us up to do it across organization. That sets it up for us to do reverse mentoring like I've been doing. So for example, I'm reverse mentoring my vice chancellor. So that's staff reverse mentoring, based on me being Black and minority ethnic, from a Black and minority ethnic group, her being white. But I'm being reverse mentored by a third year student who is a Black male, right? So again, it's because I'm also Black, but he's British born. He grew up, he's working class London based. I grew up in the Caribbean. I'm a woman, I'm older, I'm an academic. So I am now privileged. Because, you know, as academics, we kind of think, yeah, we understand what students are thinking. We understand what they need. And I realize that, you know what, I have no clue and I need to listen differently. So it absolutely sets up the opportunity for us to have these challenging, uncomfortable, but game-changing conversations across matrices, across organizations, even across professions. So again, you might argue that, you know, some of the smaller AHP professions who are saying, I've never met, so somebody did say to me, I've never met a podiatrist who was a chief executive in the NHS. So that's not about ethnicity. That's not about any protected characteristic. But they're saying, I feel powerless in the NHS. And so it could be that somebody who's a podiatrist, reverse mentors somebody from one of the bigger professions like nursing or medicine, or you know, bigger in terms of numbers, you know?
Yes, I see what you mean. So it sounds like reverse mentoring also generates more diverse thinking. And as a result of it, it kind of galvanizes this idea that you can expand your thinking, you can do even more deep thinking, you can be more open, you can be more aware of context, you can inform your own decision making by understanding the diversity of the people around you. But tell me a little bit more about role models, because what we know, both from our members and the policy work and influencing work we do within our membership, but also from our student leadership program and our students and student engagement, is that the role modeling is very important here. And I've heard from a number of people, students and academics alike, saying to me from a BME background, I don't believe I can do this job because I haven't seen anybody of my background sitting at that table. So how can I be the first person? So that role modeling, it kind of seems to be a very important factor. How do we generate more role models?
Absolutely. So yeah, visibility and seeing what is possible is important. How do we generate more role models? So we might have to do role modeling, mentoring and so on across professions. So, you know, if you are a physio, so some of the physios are telling me they're not very many Black and minority ethnic senior physios around. It might simply be that they have to be role modeled by a senior Black nurse, a senior Black doctor, or Asian doctor, or whatever else. So we might have to cross, maybe step out of our normal professional tribal, in fact, our professional tribes, right? And seek the role models across professions. And then the only other ultimate solution is we need to be actively appointing more BME staff, either in academia or if you know, if it's clinical academic careers we're talking about. So simply the numbers go up, and therefore, even if the pipeline is leaky, you've got more people coming into the system, into the academic system, and be more intentional about how we identify and make visible leaders who can be role models for younger or new to the professions, BME you know, healthcare professionals. But the other thing as well is, let's not keep doing the traditional things, which is BME healthcare workers or BME academics need BME role models or white senior role models, right? Let's also get white students to see BME senior academics as role models, because see, we then begin short-circuiting the normal assumption that when we start recruiting for diversity, we're recruiting people of lower quality. You remember that there's a lot of work about how young people, how students perceive expertise. And there's some suggestion that their ideas of what you know, expertise typically is an older European white male. Okay, so, you know, so it's not even just that BME healthcare workers, BME students, BME academics need BME role models, but we need to change the way that people of all ethnicities see BME academics, make them role models to white students, for example, you know? So I think let's not, I want to encourage us not to think traditionally about role models and who can be role models of who.
Do we teach diversity well in universities? Or if I go back a bit, do we teach diversity well at schools? In your faculty, in your day job, how do you see diversity being practiced? I will use the word practice in its wider sense. So this is both in terms of teaching, but also in terms of doing and in terms of practically empowering, allowing that to become almost part of your gene.
I mean, I suppose, you know, the correct answer is it's variable. Some places do it well, some places do it not so well. I think the difficulty is that I'm not sure it's the teaching of diversity that's the problem, but sharing and getting people to recognize that diversity is strength. Diversity is not a problem to be solved. We problematize diversity too much, I think. And I think maybe more emphasis needs to be around diversity as opportunity. And you know, here it is, you know, we have to emphasize, of course, the moral case for diversity, but also the fact that when you have diverse teams, they innovate better, they perform better, and so on, and actually persuade and make people understand that actually you should be chasing diversity, because it actually makes, it means that not even just your targets on recruiting for diversity are improved, but actually your research grant income will improve because you will do better science. Your turnover will improve. It means that your, you know, the hit on your budget will improve, and so on, you know? So I think A, it's the emphasis on diversity as not a problem to be solved, but actually as opportunity for, and therefore as mission critical, okay, particularly in the COVID recovery phase. And then again, I suppose I would want to also emphasize that probably what we need to also do is teach inclusion. Okay, how do you make sure that everybody feels safe to speak up and engage and contribute, but also how are we capitalizing on having the diversity in the room? So one of the things I noticed is that in the United States, they don't really talk about EDI, equality, diversity and inclusion. They tend to refer mainly to D&I, diversity and inclusion, because a lot of emphasis on this notion of inclusion. How do you ensure that you're capitalizing on having all these different voices and all these different perspectives in organizations? I'm not convinced we do it enough or early enough, and maybe you're right, and maybe it needs to start happening in schools. And I guess I'd be interested to know where somehow young people's views change, because people don't, you're not born understanding that diversity is a bad thing, are they? You know, they're not. So where in between when people are born and when they arrive at university or when they're in a job, when is it problematized? How does it become problematized? I suppose it is media,
family, neighborhood, yeah, media, absolutely, school, yeah, environment. Shall we move to the two pandemics clashing together over the last weeks and months? Yeah. So we've had COVID-19, important impact on people's well-being, physical and mental health and well-being across the world, actually, but not less in the UK. And obviously, we've heard once again that BME patients, members of the public, have been overrepresented. And we also had... you and I have been at meetings nationally when we've heard stories about BME students not being treated in the same way as other students as part of the pandemic. So your reflections on COVID-19 and student impact.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the broader student impact is undeniable, particularly, you know, I mean, across all subjects, not even just the healthcare subjects, but obviously, I guess I'm thinking about nursing students who are deployed now. I'm thinking about midwifery students who went out a little bit later. And I'm sure that there are students from all the other AHPs that are getting more and more involved now in giving direct care, but also even there in practice as volunteers, you know. And of course, the impact that every other student experiencing, our healthcare students are experiencing, the rapid move to online learning, being isolated, being cut off from family in some cases. That's a common set of traumas. Add on to that the fact that some of our students are in practice and are having to go into practice, having opted in, obviously, but with this thought that I'm at higher risk, you know, and you know, this varies from, you know, when adjusted for age, sex, and some other social characteristics. The risk that Public Health England published a couple of weeks ago was, I think, something 1.8 times more likely. BME communities, 1.8 times more likely to die from COVID than their white counterparts. When you then start dismantling that from BME as one big blob to specific groups, we're then looking at rates and relative risk of things like Black African men, 4.3 times more likely to die from COVID. And so you've got students going out into practice with that risk at the back of their mind, or sometimes at the front of their mind. Well, they're also dealing with the fact that they will have had more than one possibly bereavement in their family group, because if they're from a BME community and they're they're more likely to die, then they're encountering more bereavements. I was speaking to a student earlier on. We were running BME student wobble rooms, who's had four members of her family die. Now, these aren't parents or siblings, but aunts, uncles, and so on, you know. So this whole kind of cumulative grief. Then add on top of that, I had another student who was talking to about how, you know, she was out in practice. It was not designated necessarily as a COVID high risk area, but she was seeing rates of death, because actually there's not really any such thing as a no COVID area, rates of death that she'd not seen before in practice. So you've got this triple threat around grief, worry, risk, and so on. I mean, the thing, of course, is that, you know, people actually were always, you know, BME communities were always dying at higher rates of long-term conditions, non-communicable diseases, diabetes, and so on. It's just now so much more obvious and stark in front of us. And the COVID-19 pandemic has simply just highlighted what we've known for some time. There's, of course, the structural issues, like, well, are they at higher risk of getting it? Because, of course, you know, the highest proportion of nurses who are from BME backgrounds are working at band 5 in the NHS. They are more likely to be patient facing, less likely to be able to work from home, more likely to be traveling in to work on public transport. And therefore, of course, it's just shining a light again on this notion of structural barriers to moving up, and this pipeline issue. You know, our cleaners, our porters, our bus drivers, and so on. You know, so I mean, it's been a difficult thing to see. And then, you know, the clash of this other pandemic, and you know, the George Floyd thing is just a symptom of that pandemic. Students are really struggling. You know, and I can see why it's very difficult for them to process those two things happening at the same time.
You have very, very clearly described how students are feeling right now, particularly those who have had bereavement in their own families, who are seeing the Black Lives Matter movement, who are out there in practice and have seen death, in a way that they've never seen before. Mm. What is the future of student support that universities need to give students?
Yeah.
Are there any specific recommendations you would like to make to universities and to the Council of Deans, you know, representing the sector, in terms of what we should be doing less of and more of to support students through their whole period of education, both in while they are in university and when they are out in practice, particularly around both this more holistic approach you are describing, Stacey, which is not just about supporting their education, but also supporting their mental well-being.
Yeah. That's such a big question. Oh, yes. Lots of it. You know, even if we go back to something like reverse mentoring. So I guess my suggestion would be think unconventional and leave nothing off the table. So I'm doing a reverse mentoring project in the north, Liverpool John Moores University, and obviously here at the University of Nottingham. And in the early days of the pandemic, of course, I just thought, oh my God, we're going to need to pause this work because people are really busy. But then actually, people have started reaching out to me, both in the NHS and in those two universities that are doing reverse mentoring, kind of saying, actually, you know what, now more than ever, I need to hear from my reverse mentor. Now more than ever, I want to talk to my reverse mentee. And in some of the reflective practice sessions we've had with the reverse mentors and the reverse mentees, some of them separate, some of them joint, you're hearing stories of how, you know, for BME students who are reverse mentoring, perhaps a PVC, the ability to process what's happening to them and tell them about how they are experiencing COVID has actually been quite therapeutic. And similarly, for the senior leader to listen to how the experience of COVID is different to theirs has been, again, helpful to the leaders. They're saying, gosh, I hadn't thought of that. We need to provide this support. We need to do this differently. The way in which we're communicating, engaging on our COVID response needs to be different and needs to be changed. I want to sense check things with my reverse mentor, my junior, my second year student, who's my mentor, for example, my reverse mentor. So, you know, even things like reverse mentoring is helping with things like getting organizations to think differently about what their COVID response, how they might support students differently going forward. We need to recognize very clearly that normal was not working for some people. So we cannot go back to normal, right? We can't even go back to the new normal, because normal was doing some groups a disservice. Black and minority ethnic students, disabled students, students who are part-time, mature students, right? Normal is not working for some people. And we really just have to be different in the way we listen to students, you know? So I think let's not do the conventional evaluation of modules. Let's not do the conventional way that we listen, you know, organized course reps who might not be broadly collecting views across the board. Let's do town halls. Let's have other ways in which staff are engaging with students, reverse mentoring, being reverse mentored, for example. You know,
I'm hearing three key things here. Change your engagement style and structure. Be unconventional. Mm-hmm. Be brave. Mm-hmm. Be innovative. Absolutely. And diverse your thinking. And in order to diverse your thinking, you almost need to pull all those voices from everywhere.
Yeah.
And start listening to them proactively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would also say, One of the things that's really been, for me, quite magical about reverse mentoring, I'm sorry I keep going on about it, it's like I think it's the solution to everything, is that it really forces us to reverse the deficit model. So rather than thinking, why are those students struggling? Why are BME students not, why is there an attainment gap? Why are we not seeing Black professors? Why are we not seeing more, professors who are in wheelchairs and so on? Why do they not know about this wonderful policy we have? We need to be thinking more about what is it we're doing wrong as the organization that means they don't know? What is not quite right about the way we're communicating with people that means that they're not feeling their needs are being met? Okay. I mean, one of the things I noticed, and people have been saying this to me a lot when they've been receiving, you know, students writing about Black Lives Matter and so on, is a lot of the things that students are wanting or asking for, organizations and universities are already doing. So then my question is, well, how is it that they don't know that? Okay, we're not communicating with them correctly. We're not engaging with them. We're not involving them in the work, you know? And so I would say, you know, when we're starting to talk about COVID recovery, be absolutely clear and intentional on how you're going to achieve inclusive recovery. Who's on your gold command? Who's, if you have school-based silver commands, who's on your COVID recovery silver command? What ethnicity, what gender, all of that, you know? Are we really convinced that we're intentionally disrupting the normal status quo, or are we actually really going to be using methods that will, because we're going to need to innovate our way out of trouble. You know, some of the deficits or projected losses that I am hearing universities will have to bear, and we are not the worst sector, we can't do what we've always been doing. We've got to do something intentional, something radical, many intentional things, many radical things, because otherwise we're going to be in more trouble than we need to be.
You've given us a lot of energy, a lot of optimism, and a lot of hope during this conversation, Stacey. My last question to you is, can you share with me the best story you've heard about somebody proactively challenging racism and providing some constructive solutions?
That's a hard one. So I don't know if I have one big story. I mean, the first thing I would say is, it's quite normal for me to be difficult, is I'm not a fan of constructive solutions, nor am I a fan of constructive criticism. Okay. And again, this is something that has come to me because the work we've been doing on reverse mentoring is based on the work of Paulo Freire, you know, the pedagogy of the oppressed, critical pedagogy. And it's made me really understand that to dismantle structures that have disadvantaged some people, so dismantle structural racism, for example, we can't construct things. We have to first deconstruct. Okay. And often when people say to me, come to me with constructive criticism, come to me with constructive solutions, what they really mean is come and tell me the problem that is in a way that's palatable to me. Come to me with solutions that are palatable to me. Okay. So I would first of all say, let's stop looking for constructive, because actually, remember that whole process of construction just shores up existing barriers, existing structures that are disadvantaging some people, right? So I guess the first thing would be, let's maybe start thinking about deconstruction and then maybe reconstruction, right? And you know, so many stories, you know, not even my stories, but one student in one of the organizations I'm working with was mentoring a senior member of staff, and she's Black, and she started, because of course some of this reverse mentoring is going on remotely now because it's COVID, and she started the conversation with her hair normal, looking amazing, gorgeous, and then halfway through she took off her wig, and she said to the male white leader who was her mentee, "What do you think of my hair now?" And of course he was quite, you know, taken aback. It then became a conversation about, let's talk about women and hair and what you see as professional hair. She talked to him about, you know, children that had been sent home from school in London and in the north of England because they had cane rows, and all the fact that we problematize people's bodies, including their natural hair. And he was like, I had no idea that any of that kind of stuff happened, you know. One member of staff in the NHS said, reverse mentoring is the best, was it, what is it, the most important piece of work I've done in my 30 years in the NHS, she said. And she said it was because she understood racism theoretically, but listening to the stories of her BME reverse mentor was, she described it as life-changing. So I haven't got a particular story because, of course, I hear so many examples of things they've done. But I would just say, you know, again, deconstruct. Don't think about construction. Don't, if you're feeling uncomfortable, then it's a good conversation. And again, just be courageous. Be courageous, and I'll also be courageous about showing your vulnerability as a leader. Okay, so I think a lot of the times we change is resisted because you're not willing to say, "I don't know. I didn't know that. You know, tell me. Can I tell you what I did 10 years ago that I think might have been racist?" Right? And I want to encourage people listening to think differently about vulnerability. You know, it's all that stuff that Brené Brown from the University of Houston talks about. Vulnerability as strength, not as a source of shame. You know, and I want to encourage us to be vulnerable and to share what we don't know. For me, the basis of, or the foundation for this change going forward, you know, step change, is I used to talk about wanting to see leaders become more culturally competent, but I think it's something more complex than that. I've started instead talking about leaders becoming more culturally humble.
Humility is an important element
Absolutely.
here, isn't
Yeah,
it?
yeah.
Talk
Developing their
about
culture of
vulnerability.
humility. Absolutely, yeah. Because I think that cultural humility paves the way for a leader. And I you know, I don't just mean a white leader. I mean somebody like me who I'm regularly working with students where I'm like, yeah, I'm not quite sure what can I say gay out loud? Would that offend? Should I, you know. It paves the way for anybody wanting to start difficult conversations to be able to say, look, I might get it wrong. I'm not sure what the right terms are. I don't know what to say. But the conversation is so important that I'm willing to try. Help me. Tell me when I've got it wrong. Help me. Yeah. You
So
know,
it's a dialogue and an evolution, and
it's a dialogue and an
it's an
evolution.
and being humble and understanding that you're there, you're
Absolutely.
part of the conversations, you've
Yeah.
entered this space,
Absolutely.
and you want to be open to everybody else.
Absolutely. Because otherwise we don't start the conversation and people's suffering is invisible. Our students' suffering is invisible. Our junior staff suffering is invisible.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your reflections, from the tools you've given us and the tips, for your wisdom. And I'm sure that we will also have an opportunity to share some of the references you made as you were talking about the academic theoretical framework of reverse mentoring and beyond. And Stacey, thank you so much for being with me this
Course.
afternoon. It
Thank
was
you for having
wonderful,
me.
wonderful to have you.
Thank
And
you.
goodbye.
Bye bye.